You're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa. Rafa exists to improve your ride with the finest kit, inspiring stories, and vibrant clubhouses across the globe.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm at Paris-Nice. It's the morning of the final stage, and in a moment or two, I will be joined by French journalist François Thomazeau. François and I will discuss all the action so far in what's been a cracking week's racing, and later we'll reconvene to analyse the final stage. François's actually been here the whole race. I've been here for half of it, and as I say, it's been a belter so far. We'll get on to that. We'll hear from stage winners Sam Bennett and Richie Porte, Nicolas Portal and Joe Dombrowski. In the final part, I will be joined by Daniel Freeb to preview the first of the monuments, Milan-San Remo. And on that subject, you will also hear in this episode about a brilliant RAFA monuments competition with the chance of winning a cycling holiday with the RAFA Cycling Club on the French Côte d'Azur. Lots of clothing up for grabs too. There's a lot to pack in, but before we get on to any of that, let's hear Lionel Burney's news roundup. Over to you, Lionel.
It's been a week or so of very entertaining racing, both at Paris-Nice and Tirreno Adriatico. First in France at Paris-Nice, a brilliant final stage saw Alberto Contador trying to unseat Sky's Sergio Henao, and he came within a few seconds of doing it. Henao's winning margin was just 2 seconds in the end. Ireland's Daniel Martin was third, and here's Quickstep Floor's teammate Julian Alaphilippe, who had led the race for a few days after winning the uphill time trial at Montbrui, was fifth. There was also a first World Tour sprint win for Ireland's Sam Bennett, and impressive stage victories for Simon Yates at Fayence and Richie Porte on the Col de la Coyolle. David de la Cruz outsprinted Contador in Nice on Sunday, but it was Contador's final day exploits that really caught the eye. He attacked well out from the finish and put Henao and the Sky team on the back foot, but the Colombian held firm just about to secure Team Sky's fifth win at Paris-Nice in 6 years. Equally entertaining racing over at Tirreno Adriatico in Italy, BMC Racing won the opening team time trial, a discipline that they're really making their own, or they have done in the last couple of seasons. Team Sky finished only 18th of 22 teams after Gianni Moscon's wheel broke dramatically, and that dashed Geraint Thomas's overall chances of victory, although the Welshman did win the second stage. Peter Sagan won twice, including a very impressive win over a host of top climbers. Fernando Gaviria won a sprint stage to suggest that his form is good ahead of Milan-San Remo. Rowan Dennis won the final time trial, but as at Paris-Nice, overall victory went to a Colombian. It was Nairo Quintana who is building up to the Giro d'Italia, who won the toughest stage and finished on the top step of the podium ahead of Dennis and Thibaut Pinot. Adam Yates, who'd been lying second overall, abandoned during stage 5, apparently with illness, and Fabio Aru also pulled out of the race after climbing badly on the big stage. The other incident at Tirreno Adriatico, you've almost certainly seen this on social media, the incident where Peter Sagan is forced to ride up onto the pavement to avoid a pedestrian and her dog as they're crossing a pedestrian crossing during the time trial on the final day. The Women's World Tours continued with the Ronde van Vlaanderen, the Netherlands, and there was a brilliant win there for the world champion Amelie Diederichsen ahead of Elena Cecchini and Lucinda Brand. There was also a very good 8th place for Alice Barnes, who was in the same group as Marianne Vos. Off the bike, it's been another tough week for British Cycling and Team Sky. British Cycling have a new CEO with the appointment of Julie Harrington from the FA, that's the Football Association. But the report into the culture of British Cycling was leaked to one of the newspapers, and it didn't make good reading for the organisation's hierarchy. Jess Varnish has called for the whole board to resign. That story still has plenty to run, I suspect. As does the Team Sky story, which is rumbling on. There have been reports that the World Anti-Doping Agency is considering a ban on the corticosteroid that Bradley Wiggins was issued with a TUE ahead of the 2011-2012 Tour de France and the 2013 Giro. Meanwhile, Dave Brailsford says he will not resign from Team Sky. One of the best riders of her generation, Joanna Rausel-Shand, has announced her retirement at the age of 28, won a host of medals on the track, twice a Team Pursuit Olympic champion, both at London in 2012 and Rio in 2016, multiple European Team Pursuit champion and national Team Pursuit champion. Also Commonwealth Games Individual Pursuit Champion, World Individual Pursuit Champion in 2014, and several World Team Pursuit titles. The stalwart really of that Team Pursuit squad. You know, she came into it right at the start when the Team Pursuit was added to the World Championship and Olympic schedule in around 2007-2008, and has really driven the Great Britain team to a generation's worth of success. So at the relatively young age of 28, that's a big loss to British cycling. Certainly to their track programme. Anyway, in the final part of this week's podcast, Richard will be joined by Daniel to preview Milan-San Remo, which is on at the weekend, and you can hear details of Rafa's Monuments competition. I don't want to spoil the surprise by saying what's on offer or how you can win, but Richard, my guess is 6 hours, 51 minutes, 14 seconds, and we'll see how close I get.
Francois Thomazeau, hello.
Hi there.
We're speaking on the morning of the final stage of Paris-Nice. It's been an eventful race, hasn't it, from the inclement weather up in the north, and it's a race to the sun, and it's lived up to that promise this year, hasn't it?
Yeah, in terms of the weather, it's been really ideal for the organisers, because you know the legend of the race of the sun, and the more you go southwards, and the better the weather is. It couldn't be truer, because a first day of nightmarish. Well, that's what most riders said. Stage one and two were absolutely terrible, cold, windy, Echelons. I mean, the kind of mini classics, and now look at that. I mean, obviously, if I can convey this, the great glorious sunshine we have today, it's unbelievable, and it's been really like that. You know, the clouds disappearing when we got closer to Provence. I mean, it was exactly what the race to the sun is supposed to be.
Not a surprise to find a lot of security here. I was standing with a couple of colleagues yesterday at 12 o'clock when there was an explosion. Apparently it's a daily occurrence in Nice at 12 o'clock. We have the 1 o'clock gun in Edinburgh. The policeman reassured us yesterday that there was nothing to be alarmed about. But there's a lot of police and a lot of guns.
Yeah, it's the case, in most of France these days, because we're in a state of emergency since the attacks, terror attacks in the last couple of years. And Nice is even more under scrutiny because, as you know, there was this dreadful attack on Bastille Day last year during the Tour de France, and actually the attack took place like 100 meters away from here on Promenade des Anglais. They even moved the finish line. I mean, the finish line traditionally has always been there by the seafront, and they've moved it like 200 meters closer to town so that it's easier to kind of lock within barriers and make sure the security is so. You got this kind of leisurely feeling of a cycling race in the beginning of spring or something, and in the same time you can feel the tension. But unfortunately, this is the sort of things you might be spotting, but in France we grew accustomed to it now for the past couple of years. So, it's a little bit of a shame, but that's the way it is.
The race yesterday, obviously, highest summit finish ever for Paris-Nice, and we saw a really good race. I say a good race. It was, I felt at the end when Sergio Henao, who's now in the yellow jersey, cracked. It was more a case of him going backwards than Alberto Contador going forwards. Contador didn't look to me like vintage Contador, but there was a lot of hope going into the stage that Julian Alaphilippe, the great French hope, would hold on. And there's still a lot of uncertainty about what kind of rider he is and will turn out to be. Disappointment, do you think, that he wasn't able to hold on to the yellow jersey yesterday?
Had you asked me the same question at the start of Paris-Nice, I would have said no. Nobody really expected him to be so good in high mountains. But after what he did at Montbrouilly in a time trial, we started to believe everything was possible with this guy. And in many ways, we don't know what the limits of Alaphilippe are. But still, from what we know about him, and he's a great rider, probably a true champion. The problem is probably more the Jalabert type, the Sean Kelly type, the kind of rider. Well, normally you should win Liège-Bastogne-Liège, Flèche Wallonne, that kind of the type of race. Maybe this, because I mean Sean Kelly won it many times, but he could win a normal edition of Paris-Nice, not an edition of Paris-Nice with a 15-kilometer mountain pass at 1700 meters high. So no, I don't think it was really a disappointment. Probably for him, it was a little bit. I doubt Julien Alaphilippe will ever be the kind of climber that Richie Porte is or Alberto Contador is. So, no. Yesterday's disappointment in many ways was the stage itself, because apart from Richie Porte, who was absolutely excellent and very, very impressive. All the others were kind of below par. I mean, as you say, Alberto Contador is not probably not the rider he used to be. Henao cracked a little bit in the finale. Yeah, so, you know, hats off to Richie. You know, very, very... yeah, it's a shame that he actually cracked so much in the first couple of stages, because yesterday was a great performance.
Okay, well, a rider who has shone this week is Sam Bennett, the Irishman on the Bora Hansgrohe team. Bennett has been promising a big win for a long time. He's won a few races, but a stage win at Pyrenees is his best so far, and it was against world-class opposition. The likes of Marcel Kittel were here, Andre Greipel as well. The other morning, I spoke to Sam Bennett. Here's what he had to say.
Things have changed quite a lot. I mean, you must be delighted with your win this week.
Yeah, something I've been trying to do for the last at least two or three years is the next step that I was looking for, and really hard to get, and yeah, it just finally came together this year. And you could see, like, with the team stepping up and with Peter coming on board, that the resources, the information, the people behind it all, like, it, and when you put it all together, it really, the results show, and I think it's have to get me to another level at the moment. So it's just now I have to try and not be greedy, not try and get more form or get lighter or whatever, just hold where I'm at and just try and go from here then.
What went right for you in the sprint the other day? Because, I mean, you took some great scalps there. Was it, do you just find yourself in the right position? Did you, or do you feel that you've really moved up to another level this year?
Well, I did my first altitude camp this year and flying after, and I think that really helped. And that's part of it. I think I've gone pretty well. I made it over the Cat 1 climb yesterday in the front group, and it was the first one, and I was really surprised at that. So I think the shape must be better. But I think positioning is one thing that's hard. Like Patrick and the guys did a great job the other day, and I changed a bit of the gym work. Last year I think I made myself a bit slower, and this year I'm after getting the speed back. So all I needed to really do was get the engine stronger, and then get to the finish fresher, and then I can go quicker.
How big an influence has Peter Sagan been? I mean, you race with him down under, and I know you were on the altitude camp with him. I was speaking to some people on the team who said that he's been a really great influence on you in races, and encouraging you to maybe believe in yourself a little bit more.
Yeah, I think that first day he helped lead me out. I didn't want to do it, and then he told me that I had no choice, that they were doing the sprint for me. And I think when he had believed in me, that it kind of gave me a bit more confidence. And then also when you see how calm he is, he's not even stressed in the last 500 meters. Like, if it happens, it happens. If it doesn't, it doesn't. But he's like, when you stay relaxed, it normally opens up again. So I think from that, just try to relax a bit.
What's he like, you know, away from the races? What was he like to spend time with away at the camp?
Yeah, he's a great guy, but he's so normal. You know, he's always messing, and he tries to make it fun. He's all about having fun on the bike and stuff, and never making it too serious or too stressful.
I mean, do you get the feeling that if you and he are at the sharp end of races, and you're perhaps, he thinks that you've got a better chance than him, you could be quite a dangerous combination, the pair of you?
I think so. I think maybe even next week at Sanremo, he's flying, and if I can get over the last two climbs and I'm there at the right position, I think if I could get going at 400 or 300, I don't think anybody can beat him then. So I'm looking forward to seeing what we can do there.
I mean, you mentioned your climbing yesterday. You know, performances like that must encourage you to think that a race like San Remo might be one that's within your reach.
Yeah, for sure. Like the other years, I kind of really messed up my form, and this year it's coming together nicely, so we'll see how it is. Today, actually, I'm just slightly holding off a little bit of a cold, but hopefully I keep that at bay and it should be good.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science and Sport, who sponsor the cycling podcast. You can get 20% off Science and Sport products if you go to scienceandsport.com and enter the code TCP20 at the checkout. It doesn't work in conjunction with other offers, but for everything else, 20% off at the checkout. And a little reminder that we are, in conjunction with Science and Sport, offering a £14 goodie bag to UK-based friends of the podcast. Thank you very much to everybody who has signed up in the last week as a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. For £10, that will get you 11 exclusive friends specials. The next one coming up very soon. And if you're in the UK, you'll get your £14 goodie bag with gels and bidon and so on. Thank you very much once again to Science and Sport. So, Francois, we're now talking at the end of the day. The sun is setting over Nice. It's getting very chilly, actually, now. Mm-hmm. The Navy boat patrolling the waters out there still. But what an exciting final stage. Almost an exact replica of last year with Alberto Contador on the attack. He stayed away this time. And it was Geraint Thomas last year, Sergio Henao this year for Team Sky, who just managed to cling on to the yellow jersey.
Yeah, it looked pretty similar on paper. Remember that that last year, the guy who really helped Geraint Thomas win it was Sergio Henao. So he was back in it this time, only fanning for himself. And when I say fanning for himself, he was really fanning for himself, because he found himself on his own on cold days and in the descent when Sebastian Henao, his cousin, and David Lopez, finally couldn't help him anymore. So everybody's going to talk about Alberto Contador again, because obviously El Pistolero was back and attacking, swashbuckling and everything. And it was the more exciting, as you know, we were all, with our little calculators, trying to count the seconds, because Contador took 2 seconds here and lost 4 seconds there. But first of all, I think we, you know, Henao really deserves, plaudits and congrats, because he really played it safe. He rode like a leader, he never panicked. He was attacked from all sides. He stayed calm, collected, and finally won. So, hats off to him.
I mean, Sergio Henao has been a sort of nearly man for a long time. You know, think back to the Olympic road race where he crashed with Nibali when he was away in a move that would probably have won him a medal. He's had a lot of bad luck in his career. He's been knocking at the door. There's always been a question about whether, what sort of rider he is, really, whether he belongs in that sort of A category of stage races. This is his big win. He's 28 now. He was at the limit today, and certainly his team was at the limit. I think the toll of the week, we mentioned in part one, just the bad weather at the start of the week, I think that's left a lot of very tired bodies, some ill bodies as well. I think, although it perhaps wasn't the strongest Sky team here, people were probably surprised to see him with only two teammates remaining for much of the stage after Contador's attack, and then, of course, 20Ks to go. Both Sebastian Henao and David Lopez melted away. Quite a surprise, really.
Yeah, because when you look at the team, actually, with Nieve, Lopez, Sebastian Henao, well, even Luke Rowe, we know he had knee problems, but even with Rowe in there was no flat section today. But I mean, in the first part of the race, it was a good enough team to win. Well, it was actually good enough to win, and a friend of mine was making remarks that actually on the second day of the of racing, when Contador was trapped, he lost 50 seconds to Henao, and Henao was in the right echelons. He rode like a Flemish rider, so probably the win was decided in the first couple of days, and maybe not in the spectacular descent of Col d'Huez. And by and large, the Team Sky performance was, we so used to them dominating, probably it was more, a little bit less impressive than usual. But at the end of the day, they did what they had to do. They did well yesterday, and there you are. And Henao was big enough to fend for himself today, even when attacked by someone like Contador. So the overall, and let's face it, their record on Paris-Nice is even more impressive than the Tour de France. The last six years, they won it five times with four different riders. Well, it says a lot about their abilities and their capacity to dominate the season. We have the impression that Team Sky is all for the Tour, but no. Well, I mean, you know, they won Paris-Nice, they won Tour de Romandie several times. So actually, they're you know, as a team, throughout the season, they're here.
I mean, you mentioned Luke Rowe. One or two people at the Team Sky bus after the stage saying that Luke Rowe won the race for Sergio Henao. Not today, but on the crosswind stage, where I think Henao got 55 seconds, but much of that was down to the driving of Luke Rowe, who was in great form. I mean, we should pay fulsome tribute to Alberto Contador. He's an aging warrior, but there's the life in the old dog. Yeah, I said earlier that I didn't think he was at his best. He's not quite as fluid and as fluent as he's looked in the past. You know, it's hard out there, it's tough, and today was a real grind. But he rode tremendously well. I mean, for much of the stage, it was him against Henao, and it looked at the top of the Col d'Huez before the descent as if he would do it. The descent was maybe just too long, and one or two guys in that group behind sniffing the chance of a stage win. I want to mention Michael Matthews as well. We'll hear from him in the final part, but he did a terrific ride today. Team Sky, of course, embattled, beleaguered. The boss, Dave Brailsford, made a flying visit over to the race today, but kept a fairly low profile, not surprisingly, given all that's going on. We talked about this a lot last week, but we'll hear in a moment from Nicolas Portal, who I spoke to the other day about that. But wondered from your point of view, Francois, how that story is playing over here in France, the story about Team Sky. You're shaking your head.
Well, it's not been played at all, almost. I mean, we had to wait for like 3 weeks or a month before it was headlines everywhere in Britain. And in France, there was a twofold page, you know, in L'Equipe, which is the as you know, the sports daily in France, and that's about it. It's from the French point of view, when you've had the Festinat case and all the real big doping cases in the past. And like Richie Paul pointed out in an interview we made earlier in the day, at the end of the day, there was no real doping cases. You have TUEs, you have legal, everything's legal. You have, well, that's right, that ethical infringements. But in the world of cycling, the way it's been for the past 30 years, you know, it's kind of a luxury to be able to complain about ethical infringements when actually so many riders broke the rules, broke the ethics, broke everything. So in many ways we have the impression it's a little bit overplayed. The support for Team Sky has seemed to us a little bit over the top at times, and now the way the support turned into kind of hatred looks a little bit overblown as well. So
you memorably described this affair when we did our event in Edinburgh before Christmas as cycling fans in Britain losing their virginity, I think is how you put it. A very good way of putting it. You also said that doping, in your view, was a legal issue, not a moral issue. Mm-hmm. I guess the problem with Team Sky in particular is they claimed the moral high ground. They've not perhaps been true to the values that they said they were going to espouse when they started out.
You know, Team Sky is all about marginal gains. So to go as far as the law allows you to go is, I suppose, in the same mold as testing the equipment as far as you can, testing the bodies as far as you can. So testing the rules as far as you can is probably part of marginal gains. And they probably tested the press as much as they could and went a little bit too far about it. But what can I say? It's a little bit embarrassing when you think about it. Yesterday we were up in the mountains in Roubion, and Sergio Henao pledged support for Dave Brailsford, saying, "I've been there, I've been through there." You remember that Sergio Henao had this problem with his biological parameters, and there was questions whether was it doping, was it scientifically different because he lived at altitude. So, but you know, to put things in perspective, I remember Thomas Dekker, the Dutch rider, a couple of years ago, 10 years ago, winning Romandie, I think, and dedicating his win to his Italian doctor. Well, it's not exactly the same here, but it says a lot about the difference between the two situations. You had Thomas Dekker, I was almost going to say the renowned doper, you know, dedicating his victory to the doctor who gave him drugs. And here we have in NAO, you know, we had problems with. How could I say? You know, it's not really doping problems. He's been sidelined a couple of times
because, there were certainly causes for concern in his biological passport and his blood tests. Never got a full explanation for that. We were always promised a report. There was studies carried out into that, I think, at Sheffield University. We've never had the report into that, but they were satisfied that there was no doping offence and he was allowed to resume his career. The other day, Francois, I spoke to your countryman, Nicolas Portal, who's been involved at Team Sky from the start, first as a rider, now as a DS. I wanted to ask him just how all these stories, all the headlines, were affecting the riders. There's obviously a lot of talk around Team Sky at the moment. I mean, how is that affecting the riders? Is it affecting the riders? They must be very aware of the coverage.
Well, obviously, to be true, we are aware about you guys, what you are telling us, because the season starts pretty long, for a good month now, and we are going into all the week races, you know, and it's pretty tough for us. We are really focused. I think it's making a lot of noise in UK. In France or Spain or Italy, obviously, except this week because you have the first World Tour races, so everything is sparkling, you know, on the media. It's not that much. We know there's some big issue, yeah, apparently. But for us, we don't really understand that exactly what everything is behind this. We, for example, my case, and I'm really proud of what I'm doing. I'm being also backed by him from the beginning, so I trust my team. I trust what we are doing.
I was going to say, Nico, because you've been involved from the start as a rider initially, and then as a DS. I mean, in all that time, is there anything that Dave sort of admitted that there have been certainly mistakes made, but has there been anything at all that has forced you to think that you weren't entirely happy about what was going on within the team?
No, you know, but obviously, you know, probably for now I'm not a writer, so probably for the public, you know, probably we say, but Nico he cannot tell the truth because he's obviously employed by Sky. To be really honest, and people they know me, I just jump into the stuff because I did 1 year at the bike rider and I really believe in how you know Dave is bringing the team, and I say, wow, that could be for me a fantastic. I could still ride my bike until now, you know. I'm not that old. I'm quite old, but not that old. Not old, but and then I just buy in on the system, and that's just fantastic, you know. So I'm full behind Dave. I guess he is the best manager I saw. I still have some experience now, you know, on the bicycle. I started this bicycle from 14 years old, and I've been in three big teams, AG2R, Movistar, and here. And they're all really big managers, really good. But I need to say, maybe Dave is not the guy who is, you know, everything about cycling from the beginning, but he's super smart and how he's, you know, he brings people in the right place, building a motivation. On the human management, yeah, it's really good, yeah.
So some of the stories that we hear about British cycling and Team Sky, there's a very kind of ruthless culture, a culture where there's a lot of pressure on you to win. I mean, has that been your experience, or have you experienced that in a positive way?
Yeah, no, that's exactly the thing. Well, obviously, I've never been in British cycling, and for us, it's something like we cannot really understand. I get the feeling the same maybe for Pete Kennell or Jay, where they are, whoa, they're being in British cycling on the British Academy. And for us, I don't think, I mean, you can also try to ask the riders that went before with us, you know, and but I think everybody is happy to work here. We are creating our own spirit, I guess, if you can say that like this. And to be honest, when we look all this kind of, I don't know what you said in English, this attack, you know, whatever, it sounds like for me, I cannot see the same person I can one work to every day with him. So, and it's the same for us as with the bike riders. And just to reflect what we're doing, we are not affected because we see almost, you know, like Sergio and I is on a perfect place. Every day is perfect for us. We are really focused on the race, and that don't affect us. It's just like, yeah, it's just annoying.
But it must be worrying as well about, you know, the future of the team.
Well, you know, the thing is, like, you know, in any job, if you do your job well, and if you, in French, integrate, you know, and you're honest, you will have a fine job anyway. And if you can get winning like with us, we still now, you know, we came with a Team B, I heard for some other media, and we can see the small Colombian. He's been really good on the crosswind. He's like a small flyout, you know, small Belgium guy. So we're really proud of him. And now we're just sure so that this is really strong, and we just focus on this race. And no, I think we're really happy to be there.
So that was Nicolas Portal. You know, getting on with the job, I suppose. This morning, you and I, Francois, we spoke to Richie Port, the BMC rider, winner on Saturday, of course, the mountaintop finish, former winner of this race, former double winner of this race. And he's wanting to get something off his chest just about the coverage around Team Sky. So here is Richie Port.
Yeah, the team, they never lost faith in me, and the guys yesterday were brilliant. They worked fantastically well for me, so it's nice to come away from the race and salvage a little something out of it. I heard that, you know, they just let me ride away, but I don't think they just let you ride away if you sort of hit them a few times and they've come after you, you know. I think I'm climbing really well, which is, you know, it's good for this time of the year, when I've not been, you know, there's my regime's been good at home, but not what it can be. So it's good signs so early on the season. But, you know, Alberto's always good. He's always here to race. Sergio Henao's in fantastic shape. And Daniel Martin, too. He was really impressive yesterday. Yeah, look, I think with Sky, the thing with them is that they wanted to win basically everything. So, it's taken on a little bit less importance now that I've come to this team as a leader, whereas in Team Sky I was just one of the helpers. But if you could win a race like this along the way, then you know, they like that as well. But I sort of came here this year looking to win. I knew that I was in good form, and I think I showed that the last 2 days, but the disaster of Monday happened, so, you know, we are where we are, but it's disappointing to have not won the race. Yeah, look, I mean, last year was an absolute disaster in so many aspects, but I think what I learned was that, you know, when things don't go to plan, you don't have to, you know, throw the toys out of the pram, so to speak. So I think I showed that yesterday and the day before too, you know, winning the stage, being third on the stage, that even though, you know, things don't always go according to plan, let's face it, cycling never goes to plan, you know, there's always something that goes on out on the road, that you know, you can still just keep fighting and get on with it and get a good result.
What have you made, Richie, of the coverage around Team Sky? It's obviously been a huge story back in the UK. It's your former team. What's your, you know, what have you made of it all?
Yeah, I mean, it's from the sidelines, you know, it's got a bit of a negative spin on it in the press, and I think it's disappointing, because if Team Sky leaves the sport, that is not a good thing for the sport. And, you know, I think some journalists need to be a little bit more careful with what they write, because, you know, they're digging away at it so much, and you know, there's really not much that's standing up. And you know, I think I need to defend Team Sky, even though I'm not there anymore. But I mean, it's a terrific setup, and there's some absolutely brilliant people there. And at the end of the day, I don't think the riders and staff deserve some of the crap that they're going to get. And I think, you know, you come to the Tour de France and you get people there that are, you know, that hate Team Sky, and I think that's dangerous. You know, I was spat on, I was punched in that team, and I just think that, you know, some people need to be accountable for what they're saying. And you know, I think it's, you know, a little bit that tall poppy syndrome, that you know, they just want to cut Team Sky down. But, you know, there's some fantastic people there, and you know, I think that, you know, what Sky's done for this sport and revolutionized it is you know, incredible. And you know, I think it's just a shame that a lot of people that don't know what they're talking about are sitting there on the sidelines throwing stones.
Nevertheless, I mean, the question, I guess, is about the difference between what's ethical and what's legal. You must understand that that is a difficult one for fans to get their head around, that something, you know, Bradley Wiggins TUEs, for example, I know that started before you were on the team, but what are your thoughts on that? I mean, and what are your thoughts on the potential abuse of the TUE system?
Yeah, exactly. It's a massive grey area, and you know, I think it certainly needs to be addressed. And I'm just a cyclist, you know, like, it's quite a political thing, but I think, you know, it's I'd be all for them banning all that sort of thing, you know. But at the end of the day, I mean, it is what it is. It's an absolute mess, and I can see, you know, some of the points of view from some of the fans. But at the end of the day, you know, like, it's they haven't doped. It's not a doping thing. It's just, you know, that they're kind of maybe taking the mickey a little bit with those rules, but still within the rules. And there's you know, people riding around the peloton that have done far worse than that, and they don't cop anywhere near the amount of flack as what Team Sky and Bradley Wiggins do.
Did you feel when you were there that there was this grey area, and that Sky were operating in this grey area?
Not at all. Not one bit. I mean, I could put my hand on my heart and say that, and never saw anything dodgy whatsoever there. And, you know, I think, like him or hate him, I think Dave Brailsford's a lot more honest than a lot of people in the world of professional cycling.
Richie Porte there, Francois, he was I don't think that what he said will necessarily find favour with all cycling fans, certainly those who feel that Team Sky have let people down, but he's clearly angry at some of the coverage around the story.
I think he's a rider. He's been in the peloton for a long time. He rode for Saxo Bank. He rides for BMC. He has a different perspective, you know, from the British fan, obviously, because he's been in other teams. He knows he was already a rider when the Armstrong story unfolded, and he saw all those guys confessing, getting banned, you know, failing dope tests, and all of a sudden, when you put the whole Team Sky story these days in perspective, compared to the other stories he probably has seen, you know, since the start of his career, it's very petty. I mean, there's no comparison, obviously, between the Armstrong case for one thing, or even there's no comparison between Alberto Contador's 2-year suspension for failing the dope test in the Tour de France and what's happening to Team Sky these days. So it might be true that from time to time I'm not going to criticize the press. That's something I never do. I mean, I don't shoot my own, you know, myself in my foot. But I mean, sometimes we tend to put everything at the same level. When actually, in the Team Sky case, sure, there's been lying. There's been strange things happening. Maybe the NIO report you mentioned, there has been loss in the computer as well. You know, but it's all. How could I say? I'm not going to use my favorite word again, but it's it seems a little bit disproportionate with what really has been nagging and has been destroying cycling for the past 20 years.
Hi, my name is Brian, and I am localization coordinator from Rafa. My job involves making sure all the content on the website translated and localized. When all my friends went back to Hong Kong, which is where I come from, I need a sport that I can do by myself. And then I watched like a Tour de France documentary, and I was really inspired by it. And then the next day I went to cycle from London to Brighton. And afterwards, it was like the best thing ever happened to me, I think.
The Rafa Cycling Club is the largest global community of its kind. Members share their passion for the road through rides, events, exclusive club kits and racing. Find out more at rafa.cc.
Thank you very much indeed to Rafa. I hope you like our new sound that we've got this week in the podcast. We had a little bit of a spring clean. We thought we'd freshen up the sound in time for the first monument of the season, Milan-San Remo, which is coming up. And, you know, one or two riders here at Paris-Nice have shown that they might be in contention for it. We heard from Sam Bennett in the first part, and he could be a dark horse for Milan-San Remo. Who knows? His teammate Peter Sagan obviously going extremely well as well. But yeah, very grateful to Rafa for their sponsorship of the Cycling Podcast. Now, another rider I spoke to this week, another former Team Sky rider, somebody who will be very familiar to listeners to the podcast, of course, is Joe Dombrowski now at Cannondale. They had a shocker, actually. I have to say they had a shocker this week. I mean, they ended up with five riders and no team bus. They were in a white sort of transit van at the end of the race, sort of metaphor for their week here. And, you know, that they've got to Joe was a non-finisher as well. He had problems with his knee and his back after a recent crash. But the riders on that team, Pierre Roland, Tommy Altisslachter, who was a very exciting talent a few years ago, just don't seem to have moved forward. And alarm bells ringing, I think, for Cannondale, still without a World Tour win for quite a while. But I spoke to Joe Dombrowski. I was interested in his perspective on what had been going on at Team Sky as well. Apologies for, you know, dwelling so long on this story, but it is the story that I think, judging by our mailbag, our virtual mailbag, our emails and so on, and thanks very much for all your correspondence on it, both good and bad. It's been very interesting. Maybe next week when I'm joined again by Daniel Freeb and Lionel Burney, we'll read out a few of the emails. Very divided opinion, but you know, some really interesting, thoughtful responses to the story. Anyway, here is Joe Dombrowski. This is before he pulled out the race, talking about himself and what he recalls of his time at Team Sky. So, Joe, we're Friday morning. You mentioned that the sun's out. Day, what is it, six of Paris-Nice?
I think so.
Five. Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Six.
I don't know what day of the week.
The sun's coming out. We're getting close to your home in Nice. How are you doing? I mean, you mentioned when I spoke to you yesterday, you've had a problem with your knee. You had a bit of a hard day yesterday. What's the sort of form of fitness like at the moment?
Right now, it doesn't seem to be very good. I think I haven't looked at the results, but I've been told that I'm occupying the Lantern Rouge spot, the much esteemed Lantern Rouge spot. So, no, I haven't been riding great here, but looking back on it, I was meant to start racing about a month ago, and then I crashed on a descent in training, and I had some time off, and then after starting again, I had some knee problems, so they pulled me from racing, and I went to Tenerife for a while, and kind of just did some easy riding. So I wasn't sure exactly where I would be when I came here, and obviously Paris-Nice is not necessarily the ideal first race of the season, but yeah, I've been getting through it. And you know, I spoke to JV yesterday, because obviously he's the boss, but he also writes my training, and you know, he was like, don't worry about it, you may come around the last few days, but if not, you know, looking back at the last month, you kind of had things derailed a little bit, so don't stress it, we can get it fixed pretty quickly. So,
and as last year, I think the Giro is big target for you, certainly early part of the season.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the main goal again. I think Giro, Tour of Swiss. I do Trentino as well before, which, you know, I want to be riding good when I'm there, because that's, you're getting pretty close. And it seems like it suits me pretty well this year. I haven't looked at the stages in detail, but it seems like it's mostly just mountain stages. I guess it's true of the Alps now.
The other big story away from the race is your former team, Team Sky. A lot of stories around that. Is that something that the riders are talking about a lot in the bunch?
Well, to be honest, these first 5 days in Paris-Nice, there hasn't been much talking. Because, I mean, if you've been watching on TV, you know it's been crosswind almost every day and bad weather, and we've had the time trial. And even yesterday, which on paper seemed like it could have been relatively easy going, it was pretty fast. So being my first race and this not being the sort of race so far where you can sit at the back and chat and trade rice cakes, I haven't gotten too much gossip.
I mean, you joined the team 2013. You know, in your time at the team, you were there 2 years, I think. Did you ever have any sense, there's nothing proven against them at all at this stage, obviously, but did you have any sense of things going on within certain parts of the team that, you know, it's obviously a big number of riders, staff, etc. Did you feel that, you know, there were elements within the team where things might be going on that, you know, perhaps would constitute, if not illegal practice, then maybe ethically questionable?
Right. I guess I didn't really get that sense when I was there. You know, you can obviously only speak for yourself. So, you know, from what I could see, everything seemed pretty pretty cut and dry. And I never saw anything sort of untoward. But, you know, again, it's like you don't know what's going on that you're just not aware of. So,
I mean, it's interesting. You're an interesting case, because the thing that they're most famous for is the marginal gains, attention to detail. you were a very talented, promising young rider who came into the team. Great things were expected of you. I remember, in fact, Dave Brailsford speaking at the end of 2012 about the responsibility he felt to Mrs. Dombrowski.
I was actually trying to find that article recently.
Yeah. That was a time when they were reassuring people that they were doing things the right way. And yet, you know, with the problems you had physically, they didn't apply that attention to detail to you.
No, it wasn't. I don't think it was handled very well. And, you know, I don't know if that was a lack of experience and knowledge or if it was just, you know, not allocating. Like, maybe it was I don't know if it was a case of that or if it was a case of, you know, I'm not high on the totem pole at Sky. You know, they're out there to win the Tour de France. And, you know, a neopro's injury isn't top of their list. So I don't know if it was more of that. But it was mostly down to myself to get it figured out. And I think it actually took longer than what it would have because, you know, they wanted everything to be done within the team's medical staff. But it sort of took me pushing, trying to go see, you know, specialists about it to get the problem diagnosed and fixed. So it is interesting to me. It's like, you know, to the public, there is this very cutting edge, marginal gains sort of, I don't want to call it a facade, but when I look at it, it's like, I almost feel like there's more attention to detail now in a much smaller, lower budget team that I'm at now. And that may be a combination of, like I was saying, like now you're higher on that totem pole, so to speak. So there's more attention, but I don't know. It's hard to say. But yeah, I guess in that situation, my experience there wasn't great.
I mean, I was keen to ask you personally where you draw the line, because a lot of the discussion has been about the line, you know, and where the line is in terms of what, you know, we're not talking really about illegal practice here, we're talking about ethically dubious things, say taking tramadol, a painkiller that's not banned, or, you know, using cortisone out of competition, which is permitted. How do you make these decisions as a rider? How do you, you know, and if a doctor was to come to you and say, you know, you can take this, Joe, you're allowed, how do you... Is it your own personal moral compass? What is it? And where do you personally draw the line?
I think it has to be your own personal moral compass because, yeah, I mean, the reality is that, you know, there are things that are legal or may even be, you know, say with the case of like these TUEs for cortisone, it's hard to say whether that's legal or not because if you're exploiting it for a non-valid reason, then it is technically illegal, right? So... But it's hard to say like what's valid and what's not. And I think that's where personally the governing body needs to step in and just come up with a better scenario for it. I mean, personally, I think in the vast majority of cases, if you need cortisone for something, which I think is relatively rare, you probably shouldn't be racing anyway for your own health. And I know it's professional sport. There's a lot of pressure on athletes to perform and a lot of pressure on teams to have their athletes perform. But, you know, maybe that's the best way for us to approach it in terms of moving forward. And I mean, me personally, it's like, I don't know. I've never taken a caffeine pill. I've never taken a painkiller in my life as a cyclist. And I'm very much against that sort of thing. And, you know, some people might think that's silly and it's over the top. But to me, it's like, I don't think that should be a part of the sport. Like, why are you taking painkillers to race your bike, you know? And I recognize it's legal. And is it a performance aid? Yeah, probably. But I just choose not to do that.
Always good to hear from Joe. Best of luck to him as he recovers from his setback here at Paris-Nice. Francois, we want to look ahead a little bit to Milan San Remo. We've seen... few riders. I mentioned Michael Matthews earlier. He's somebody who is certainly gunning for Milan San Remo, and you've got guys in Italy at Torino, of course. Who are your picks for San Remo? It's always such a fascinating race because it's a race where so many different riders can start with a chance.
It's very, very difficult to say. You'll always have the same bunch of Italians in the top 10. Like we've seen Sonny Colbrelli here winning the stage, and he's had top 10 results in the past. You can never, you know, rule out a surprise winner there. But I mean, it was obvious that some of the sprinters here in Paris-Nice were really gearing up for Milan-San Remo. From what I've seen, Arnaud Démare is very strong. He could really be a challenger to defend his own crown. The other one who was good when he decided he had to be was John Degenkolb. He has a lot to, he has to make amends. And as you know, he missed lots of last season after that terrible crash. He's revengeful. He's skilled. He's gifted. He looks strong. He looks in great shape. He has a lot of time to make up for. Degenkolb will be, of course, a major force to reckon with. Peter Sagan, obviously, will always be mentioned. There are, and today, we learned this morning at the start of the stage that Alexander Kristoff had given up, didn't start today's stage. And some rumors said that he had been spotted on the Italian roads already, checking the Milan-San Remo course. So, we can't, rule Kristoff out either. But I'd say Démare and Degenkolb looked good this week, and they'll probably, if I had a little bit of money to put on somebody, I would go for maybe Degenkolb 1, Démare 2.
Well, I think it was Rob Hatch, our colleague, Eurosport commentator, spotted Degenkolb the other morning out doing extra miles before one of the stages, so he's obviously been working hard for that. Francois, we should head off now. We've got transport to catch. You're just along the coast here in Marseille.
Yeah, I'm not too far away from home. I mean, there's always been a rivalry between, this part, because that's the posh luxury part of the French Riviera, whereas Marseille is, the working, it's the Liverpool of the South, It's I feel at home a little bit. Same fish in the plates, in the restaurants, same pastis in the glasses. A slightly different accent, and certainly lots more money.
A bit more bullshit in Nice?
They're full of bullshit here.
I just wanted you to say it. Fantastic. Well, listen, Francois, you're going to be joining us at the Tour de France. You're going to be a member of the team at the Tour de France, which I'm delighted to reveal in this week's podcast. Are you looking forward to that?
Yeah, I'm very excited about that. I was not planning to do the Tour, actually, this year for the first time in 30 years. I decided I might spend a little bit of time on the beach in July and write a couple of books, maybe. Yeah, but I mean, the experience we had in the winter, touring London and parts of Scotland to discuss cycling was, really a very fine moment. And I'm really delighted to be part of the team. I mean, it's a honour. I'm thrilled, and it'll be fun.
Become a friend of the podcast to access 11 exclusive shows for just £10. To sign up, go to thecyclingpodcast.com.
I've bid adieu to Francois Thomazeau. Well, I did so a couple of days ago, and I'm being joined now by Daniel Freeb. Hello, Daniel.
Hello, Rich. How's it going?
It's going all right. Yes, we're going to talk a little bit, look ahead to Milan San Remo. We're talking just after the end of Treno Adriatico, the other sort of pre-Milan San Remo stage race. Before we get on to that, I should mention the competition that I mentioned right at the start, the Rafa Monuments competition. Thank you very much to our sponsor, Rafa. They're running a competition for each of the five monuments, which are, of course, the five big one-day classics. All you need to do to enter is to guess the winning time. Quite an unusual competition, the winning time for each of these races. First up, Milan-San Remo, and the chance to win a 3-day, 5-star cycling holiday with the Rafa Cycling Club on the French Côte d'Azur, including flights, a full set of Rafa Cycling Club kit, and a Rafa Cycling Club membership for a year. But the best part of this competition is that all you have to do to get a 20% discount is to enter the competition. Go to visit.rafa.cc/win. That's visit.rafa.cc/win. Enter your time by midday on the day of the race, and all entrants, as I say, get a 20% discount to use on the Rafa site or in clubhouses globally. So well worth taking part. Terms and conditions for the competition are on the Rafa competition page. So Milan-San Remo was won last year by Arnaud
Arno Demare in 6 hours and 54 minutes. Daniel, what's your guess?
6 hours and 4. How is that significant? 6 hours and how many
it's
minutes?
It's not. It's not. That's why it's quite an unusual competition. Right. Not guess the winner, guess the winning time. What's your guess?
Hang on. Did you know? Just give us the answer. Oh, how? Oh, this year.
That was the answer for last year.
Oh, I see. Well, I was looking at the weather forecast, actually, Rich, and it looks very similar to last year. It's going to be warm-ish, about 18 degrees, I think, and about a 15-kilometer wind coming off the sea, so and maybe partly into the riders' faces as they get onto the Riviera, so which will slow things down slightly. So I think it'll be very, very similar to last year. I'm going to go 6 hours, 41 minutes.
Well, that's fast. That's fast. I think 2 years ago it was around there. I'll go for 6 hours, 52 minutes. There we go. So completely random, but they'll be running this competition for each of the monuments, so we'll mention it again, and obviously well worth taking part for that 20% discount. Daniel,
yes.
Milan San Remo, it's one of your main appointments of the season, I would say, Milan San Remo. They have fairly consistently tweaked the course for Milan San Remo. Anything new or different this year?
Absolutely nothing, Richard. Interestingly, I think I mentioned this on the podcast a few weeks ago. I'd had a chat with Mauro Venni, who's the race director, of the Giro d'Italia, also Milan San Remo, about the course. And this winter was one of the first winters for many years in which we'd not really heard any rumours, any suggestion that the course was going to change, which struck me as curious. I put that to Mauro Venni, and he said that, in fact, he'd changed his mind because some listeners will remember 3 or 4 years ago, it was actually after Simon Gerrans won, which was 2012, was it? Vincenzo Nibali had attacked spectacularly in the finale, as he often has.
As is traditional.
Yeah, and had been caught, and Venni sort of lamented the fact that a rider of Nibali's ilk didn't seem to be able to win Milan San Remo anymore. And he, at that point, seems to be lobbying for big changes. And then a couple of years later, they were about to unveil the La Pompeiana, the climb that has been talked about for years and years, which would have come between the Cipressa and the Poggio, a pretty difficult climb. But then landslides scuppered that plan. And it was going to finally make its debut the following year, be premiered the following year, but never was. And now Venni says that he sort of reconciled himself, having spoken to a lot of the riders, and a lot of the sprinters in particular, he's reconciled himself to the fact that there is really only one classic in the year, one monument that is open to the sprinters that can be won by the sprinters, and they deserve to have their one shot at glory. And he's quite happy now for Milan San Remo to fulfill that brief in the calendar. So doesn't look as though there are going to be any changes for the next few years.
So, I mean, we heard Francois' predictions in the last part. He fancies Arno Demare, John Degenkolb, both pretty solid picks, both rode pretty well at Milan-San Remo. Arno Demare in particular rode extremely well to win the first stage. And Degenkolb looked like he was building towards other targets. A rider I was very impressed with was Michael Matthews, his first race of the season. This has been his approach the last few years. He's started his season at Paris-Nice quite late, especially for an Australian. He misses the Tour Down Under. And he was running for his new team Sunweb, and he seemed to get better as the week went on. He almost, he rode very well in the short time trial. He crashed there, but he rode extremely well, and rode very well on Sunday's final stage. Seemed to be climbing well, and Milan San Remo is his big goal. So he's been close in the past, and I thought he looked very sharp. Who are you thinking, Daniel? I mean, I mentioned we've just watched Tirreno Adriatico, the irrepressible, ubiquitous Peter Sagan was. He was Peter Sagan, wasn't he?
He was for it. Do you know what I've done?
It was a very Sagan.
Do you know what I've done?
Sagan performance.
I've actually done some homework of sorts, and I've actually come up with some star ratings. You know, the L'Equipe and La Gazzetta always do star ratings on the morning of the big classics. Mm. 1 to 5. 5 obviously being the biggest favourites. Do you want my star ratings?
Okay, but it's quiet, didn't you?
Been a busy
didn't
boy.
Tell me this.
Been
a busy I could have done my star ratings. Go on then.
You can disagree with mine instead. Right, should we start with 1 or 5?
Oh, I think start with 1.
Okay, 1. Well, I'll start at the bottom, but actually the top, as far as we're concerned, because I'll start with Filippo Pozzato. 1 star. You know, Pozzato is out in Gran Canaria at the moment.
I saw that.
Because his team was not invited to Tirreno Adriatico, so he's been in the Canary Islands. And yesterday, his derailleur broke, his electronic derailleur broke, and consequently, he's had to train for at least 1 day this week, but I'd like to think the whole week, solely in the big ring, 54 chain ring. So interesting approach for the peacock of San Diego, il pavone di San Diego. So 1 star Pozzato, got a great record in Milan San Remo, actually, although we do mock him on a regular basis. Philippe Gilbert, another guy with a good record in Milan San Remo. Viviani, a guy with a poor record in Milan San Remo. And my mate, the vanity signing, Kawasaki, tacked on that's Kwiatkowski of Sky, tacked on the Poggio descent last year. So they've all got 1 star. 2 stars, Bonifazio, Alaphilippe, Boonen, Court Nielsen of Orica, Ewan of Orica, and Fabio Fellini of Trek Segafredo. 3 stars, Van Avermaet, Sonny Colbrelli, Jürgen Rolands, guy with a fantastic record in Milan San Remo, Ben Swift, another one. Another horse for the course, and Edvald Boasenhagen. So they're 3 stars. 4 stars, Buhani Sagan. I've only given them 4 stars. Christoph, Matthews, Degenkolb, Demar, and Cavendish. And only 1 rider with 5 stars. Who is, Richard?
Fernando Gaviria. Where was that Arnaud Demar there?
4.
4, sorry, I misheard that.
What do you reckon?
Yeah, Gaviria. Well, Gaviria... He looks like such a there doesn't look like to be much that he can't do. He won a stage at Tirreno the other day, of course, untested over this sort of distance.
No,
I suppose you could say.
No, he's not untested over this sort of distance. He came 5th last year and he won Paris Tour, which is 250 kilometers.
All right. Yeah, he won. I mean, his win at Paris Tour was good. It showed real improvisation, didn't it? He didn't leave it to the last sort of kick. He went pretty early. A move like that could work at Milan San Remo. Yeah, I'd forgotten about last year. He's also in a very strong team, isn't he?
He is. Well, I've got slight reservations about that in the sense that, you know, they've got Gilbert, they've got Boonen, and they've got Alaphilippe, and they've also got Matteo Trentin. All guys who you would think could be dangerous in their own right. The ideal tactic you would think for a team at Milan San Remo would be to have someone who was ready to go in moves towards the end, Cipresso or Poggio, and which would then allow the team sprinter to sit back in the wheels in the main peloton and obviously not do any work. The problem with that is I think you can. Your attacking rider can be the catalyst, can precipitate things happening in the race, which then can possibly distract the sprinter slightly. You know, the sprinter can be sitting there in the peloton. We've heard this from riders before. They're sitting there, they're not sure whether it's all going to come back together. They're not sure what other teammates are going to do and how they're going to be able to help them and how they're going to react. So if you imagine a situation where Alaphilippe goes on the Poggio, which you would imagine... He's probably only in the team with a view to making some kind of move or marking moves on the Cipressa and the Poggio. You imagine Gaviria sitting there in the bunch. Is that going to be a slight distraction? Is it going to distract the director sportives? It could create uncertainty. I mean, I just noticed in the finale last year, and I've noticed this on numerous occasions in the past, that there tend to be moves go on the descent of the Poggio and at the bottom of the Poggio. This is kind of the last chance saloon for guys who are not pure sprinters. And Sagan has typically followed those moves and he's been in amongst those moves. Cancellara has done that in the past as well. But often those guys do not end up doing particularly good sprints. Even if they're not expending too much energy in following those moves and being in and around those moves. The guys who tend to do the better sprints are the guys who have been in the bunch the whole way and come from behind and have really, I suppose, been focused on the kind of sprint they're going to do the whole time and not really been thinking about following moves and watching what else is going on. They really put all their eggs in the one basket, which is the sprint basket. And I think that's been Sagan's big weakness over the years. So he's the problem that Sagan has is that he could win in numerous different ways. And I think sometimes he's been a little bit indecisive and maybe spent too much energy messing around and worried that someone's going to nip away at the bottom of the Poggio. So I think he really should try, and maybe will try, a San Remo where he simply sits in the wheels.
Yeah, play a waiting game, which maybe doesn't come all that naturally to him. Mark Cavendish, 4 stars. So has he been bluffing at Tirreno? As he did in 2009 when he went on to win Milan-San Remo, he's almost been a spectator, it seems.
Yeah, I mean, he's had some illness certainly at the start of Tirreno. But as for the theory that he's been bluffing, I mean, you mentioned 2009. He's also done that in subsequent years. Not always, but...
how do we know if he's bluffing or just... Because he's only won Milan-San Remo once. So that's the only year we know categorically he was bluffing.
He was bluffing. But I think... Cavendish, we've seen over the past few years that his focus has been ever more, was ever sharper on the big races. And he intends to treat everything that comes before and after as a preparation, as a build-up race. So I certainly wouldn't rule him out. He wrecked the course with Boissenhagen a couple of weeks ago. Boissenhagen doesn't have a particularly good record in Milan-San Remo, but was in the shake-up last year. They've also, they've got an interesting team, and a team that's riding well. Jansen van Rensburg has been very strong at the start of the season. Steve Cummings is a guy who I think has a good San Remo in him. He was pretty prominent in the finale last year. He's the kind of guy who... if he went around about the Cipressa or even before the Cipressa, he's one of the very, very few guys in the peloton who you would think might be dangerous from that position. We've seen so many moves go.
But you would imagine he would be alert to that with his track record. Now, he's obviously riding well, though. He rode a very strong time trial in the final stage of Tirreno Adriatico. It was, a good indicator that he's in form. There are so many riders who can win this race, but it seems to me there are a greater number than ever of what you would call non-pure sprinters, these Degenkolbs, Matthews, Christophs, Gavirias, Sagans, really fast finishers who can who are just more than just pure kind of sprinters who would excel on flat stages.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are a couple of other riders who perhaps wouldn't usually be in the very top echelon, but whose record in Milan-San Remo is such that you can't write them off. Guys like Ben Swift, who was second last year, and Jürgen Roelants as well, is a guy who tends to reserve his best performances for Milan-San Remo. And I'm really curious to see what Magnus Cort Nielsen does, because as I said a couple of weeks ago, I think he's a rider with all the attributes of a potential Milan-San Remo winner, but he's obviously not got a huge amount of experience as the young Danish Orica Scott rider. And they've got Ewan in the team, who's had some problems in the build-up to the race, hasn't he? Pulled out of Tirreno. It'd be interesting to see how they play their cards as well.
You didn't mention Sam Bennett, who we heard from earlier in this episode, and Sam Bennett, has proven himself against the best. He's still... He was certainly talking about Milan-San Remo as a race. He's curious to see how he fares there. If he gets to the finish, if it's a fairly big bunch that gets to the finish and he has a clear sight at the line, don't rule him out, I think. He's also got Peter Sagan as a teammate, of course.
Yeah, and it's it's a race, Rich, just finally, that we've seen in the past with Cavendish, and we also saw with Gaviria last year. The fact that a guy is riding Milan-San Remo for the first time does not rule them out a priori. You know, we've seen debutants. It is quite a straightforward race. I mean, the big unknown, the big difficulty is really the distance. A lot of guys who have never ridden San Remo will never have ridden the distance of San Remo, never have ridden 290 kilometres in a single day in their lives. And that can be it can be their undoing.
Sorts of wheat from the chaff. Well, thank you very much, Daniel. We'll be back next week to review Milan San Remo. It's a fantastic race to watch. Always look forward to it. Just to finish up this week, can I urge our listeners to cast a vote for the cycling podcast at the inaugural British Podcast Awards. If you go to britishpodcastawards.com/vote, there's an open vote for... I think the listener's choice is the category. So it's a kind of all podcasts are eligible for that. We are up for an award there. So please do go and register your vote if you'd like to, or vote for someone else if you'd prefer. I hope you like our new sound this week that we've got in the episode. The music is by Cantaloupe. The track is called Splish, and the band is on the Hello Tor record label, co-founded by one of our producers, Tom Wally. Nothing to do with Tor Hushoff, I don't think. Thanks very much to Cantaloupe for letting us use their music. You can find them on Twitter at Hello Cantaloupe. That's Cantaloupe. Thanks again to our sponsors, Rafa and Science and Sport, and to this week's producer, Matt Field. And thank you very much to you, Daniel.
Thank you, Rich. See you next week.
The Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa. Find us on Twitter at cycling_podcast and also on Facebook and Instagram.
When you think work, you think boots. You think boots, you think Ariat. You think grit, concrete, rain, and heat, and boots that never back down from any of it. You think comfort and durability that hold up on the job, off the clock, and every step in between. Because the day doesn't end when the job does. And from overtime to off-duty, you're thinking Ariat boots. Boots that show up, stand out, and always back you up. Now, it's time to stop thinking and start shopping. Find yours at Ariat.com or a retailer near you.